I'm Studs Terkel. Welcome. You're about to hear excerpts from several thousand interviews I've conducted during my, well, let's call it a checkered career. All this on radio station WFMT, Chicago. Arthur Miller, distinguished American playwright, memoirist, and for that matter, president of PEN, the International Writers Congress. This memoir of yours, which is your life, in a way, it's also the life of our society to a great extent, isn't it?
Well, the idea was that I didn't think that people any longer remembered what the hell had happened in the last 30, 40 years. And I met people of my own generation who couldn't remember, which is what really amazed me. So from time to time, about, I don't know, 10 years ago, I would make a stab at writing just as though I were Tacitus writing about the Romans or something, or about the German tribes up in the north, and see if I could revive the feeling of a time of the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and so on.
There's been the Depression, World War II, the Cold War that follows. In the meantime, there is this writer, and the various avenues his life takes artistically and in the flesh. Well, I've got to ask this, the only reference I'll make to Marilyn Monroe, and that is when you were being tried, even in the sense it was a trial, you defied HUAC. You said you speak of yourself, you do not believe in naming names. And they would have dropped the whole case. Congressman Walter was chairman of HUAC of Pennsylvania. If I could pose, you can get your wife, Marilyn Monroe, to pose in a picture with me, we'll drop the whole hearing.
Absolutely.
Is that true?
Oh, yeah. That would be the end of it. That happened when we were in Washington.
Well, of course.
That proposal was made to Joe Rao, my lawyer.
Your lawyer. But, of course, what that tells you is that the banality.
And when I refused, incidentally, just to complete the story, within a day, because it was a day before I was to appear in front of the committee, they were treating me as though I was an imminent danger to the country. But I was a danger to the country, which they would forget about with one photograph. And endless numbers of people took this seriously. You see, I had written The Crucible 4 years before this, of course, and it had gone on before this. And in the time of the high fever of the un-American thing, it was inexpressible, my feeling that the whole thing was completely unreal. But how to express its unreality without people saying, well, you're just dismissing a very important thing, and a social event of the first importance. And I kept saying, these guys are comedians, and you're treating them as though they're doing tragedy, see? Anyway, I had to achieve a distance from it, or I couldn't get people to consider the thing in some perspective, and therefore...
I think you just hit something. See, they're comics. You see, we have, in this world of entertainment as the key, and shopping, and everything so transient, the comic becomes the sage.
Yeah.
He's the statesman, and we take him seriously because our own values become banal.
Well, your president of the United States is a member of the profession.
Yeah. We can't end this particular sequence without coming back to Hollywood again. Another producer, Harry Cohn. And Harry Cohn wanted, you were thinking about this movie of the gangster control of the waterfront against some idealistic longshoreman.
Well, just briefly, he was interested in this screenplay of mine, which, saying that it wouldn't make a dime, and he was only going to do it because he wanted Kazan to work for him someday on a different film, but he'd do him a favor and do this film in order to tie him up. And anyway, so we all came to an agreement. He would finance the thing, and he said... there's just one more thing. He said, I want you to talk to my labor relations man, because it was about a union, the ILA. And I met the labor relations man, who thought it was marvelous, and he saw no problem in it, and Cohn was very impressed with him. And next thing I know, Cohn says, well, I can't okay you. We've got to get the FBI to look at it. Why the FBI? Well, because... the Korean War was on, you see, and they were worried that any trouble with that union that this picture might create might disturb the flow of war supplies over the docks for the troops. This was the excuse. Anyway, I went home, and the next thing I know, I get a call from Kazan, who was reporting to me what Cohn had told him, namely that they would do the picture, provided all the gangsters in the picture, who were the heavies, would be turned into communists. Well, I knew the communists on the waterfront. There were two of them. Well, at most three. And to turn these guys into... the absurdity of it was simply asphyxiating. So I said, oh, no, thanks. I don't think we want to do this film. Next morning, I get a wire from Harry Cohn, says, it's interesting that the minute we decide to make the script pro-American, you pull out.
Here again we come to the comics, don't we? We come to the comics in power. Here's a burlesque clown in power. So this is a theme in your life, in your heart, Bo. You face the absurdity. There are key moments in history, in the history of the human species, and there's the temporary nature of someone like Willie, the universal figure, feels he's disposable. There's the crucible and hysteria in the air. But throughout, there are these clown figures who are always there.
Oh, yeah. They are the mainstay of the human race. I mean, if God exists, he's a comedian.
And so a couple of years after The Blacklist, Mahalia is now big. CBS calls her, a 26-week show, Mahalia Jackson. She says, I want Studs to be the host. And they say, okay, they didn't know much about it. It's okay, the host and the narrator. About the third week, we're rehearsing and going through stuff. When a guy comes in, another guy from New York. So there's a guy from New York coming in. This is CBS. Les was NBC. And he says, he handed me a piece of paper, Mr. Turkle, the Studs. You would sign this. It's a loyalty oath. I said, wow. But I'm going to sign it. No. Is this for everybody? No, just for you. Oh, wow. But no, thank you. I don't believe in that. And so my head is passing by. She says, hey, baby, is that what I think it is? She knew about me. She always says, Studs, you got a loud mouth, such a loud mouth. You should have been a preacher, she said. And so, is that what I think it is, baby? I says, yeah. Well, let's rehearse. Do you want to do it? I says, no, of course not. And the guy says, but he has to, Miss Jackson. He has to. He doesn't have to, and he doesn't want to do. But Miss Jackson, he says, now look, you tell those people, if they fire Studs, to find another Mahalia Jackson. You know what happened? Nothing. He disappeared. He vanished. We played the run. What's the moral of it? She said no. She had more, in that moment, she had more Americanism in her than General Sarnoff, William Paley, all the sponsors, agencies, and networks put together. And that's what it's about. So Lindham wrote a book called Craven Time. Oh, it's while with Mahalia, I interviewed Martin Luther King. He came to visit her. And at her bedside, she was ill and did a long interview with him.
Dr. King, who happens to be passing through, traveling 275,000 miles a year, just bringing a truth to people, and now being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for 1964. And we're seated at the bedside of a mutual friend of ours, who's the finest gospel singer in the world, Mahalia Jackson. Dr. King, this dream that you spoke of at the foot of the Lincoln Memorial last August of 63, when did this dream first come to you, this dream of equity?
Well, this has always been my dream as far back as I can remember, even as a teenager growing up. I dreamed of a time that our nation would erase this ugly problem and that we would be able to live as brothers and that the Negro could walk the earth with dignity and self-respect. So this has been a dream for many, many years now.
I'm thinking of people who perhaps influenced you in your growth. Your father, I imagine, was an influence in your life. Is.
Yes. The one thing I always remember and always will remember about my father is the fact that racial segregation was an evil system in his mind and one that he was determined not to adjust to, and that he did not allow his children to adjust to, in the sense that he always taught us that we, even though we had to face the reality of the system, that there was a sense of somebodiness within us that always kept us moving toward the sense of dignity and self-respect that any human being should have.
I'm thinking, of course, of how this hurts the white child as well as the black child. The hurt, the separation, the hurt is to both, really, is it not?
Yes, it certainly is. Segregation injures the soul or the mind of the segregated as well as the segregator. It gives the segregator a false sense of superiority, and it so often leaves the segregated with a false sense of inferiority. So it does scar the soul of both.
It's the jailer and the jailed, both equally injured.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Isn't the phrase you used, hate hurts the hater as much as the hated?
Yes, yes. Hate is a dangerous force, and it is an injurious force because it injures the object of hate as well as the subject of hate. It injures the hater as well as the hated, and this is why many are saying love or perish.
You're thinking about this element of the revolutionary aspects of love. You yourself, when you went to Morehouse College with Dr. Mays as president, your growth, Thoreau played a role. Your father, then Thoreau.
Yes. Well, Thoreau played a very significant role in that. I came to see when I first read his essay on civil disobedience, which I read my second year in Morehouse College, that non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good.
I'm thinking of the thread that has created Martin Luther King, Thoreau, and then there was Gandhi. Your reading of Gandhi, about
yes.
Individual man as an end rather than a means.
Yes. Well, Gandhi, by far, did more than any human being to lift the love ethic of the New Testament of Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount, to the powerful level of socio-political action. The whole nonviolent movement that we see in the United States today is greatly influenced by Mahatma Gandhi, and particularly the revolutionary work that he did in India.
Thinking of love is revolutionary. Love as a technique for social transformation. Love.
Yes, exactly. And this, on the whole, we had seen love merely in terms of individual relations. But what Gandhi did was to lift the love ethic to this great level of social transformation, so that not only must an individual love an individual, but a whole racial group must love another racial group, and that somehow through this love process organized into mass action, we can bring about powerful social change.
Now, I'm thinking as we're sitting here with Mahalia listening to us and nodding, I want to ask you later on about this matter of humor through adversity.
Yes. Well, I think you've got to have the ability to engage in creative laughter in order to live amid difficulties and tension. If you can't laugh in life, you're a very miserable human being. And I think a great deal of truth often comes through laughter. And some people have developed the talent to get this truth over to many people by laughing the truth into them and out of them. So that I think humor is most important in getting at truth and getting people to understand and often to arise above the despair which can surround them.
So this laughter through adversity, the humor of adversity to survive.
Yes, yes, that's exactly right. So often people misinterpret the laughter of the Negro. It's a deeper laughter. It's the kind of laughter that molds a creative optimism out of very pessimistic situations. And it is the laughter that kept the Negro slave going amid a very trying and difficult and bewildering situation.
Well, Dr. King, I know you have to rush off on so many of your engagements. How you do it, I don't know. Thank you very much as we pass through here, stopping by Mahalia's. I hope this is chapter one, and congratulations on behalf of all of us as being the Nobel Prize winner for 1964.
Thank you very kindly.
Which leads, of course, to the interview I remember best, you know. What interview? And I'm jumping the gun. I know he's going to ask me. Which interview? And it's always like saying, who's your favorite child? So what was my interview I best remember? Well, I did see Bertrand Russell during the Cuban Missile Crisis in his cottage in North Wales. That was interesting. I did see Chief Albert John Luthuli in apartheid South Africa through the tip from Nadine Gordimer. He was the predecessor of Nelson Mandela, who was in Robben Island prison at the time. And under that was a pretty exciting one. But the most indelible one was with the former Grand Cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan of Durham, North Carolina, named C.P. Ellis. And I'd find this guy, because I read about this guy, former Klansman, now traveling with a black woman, organizing janitorial unions, custodial unions. Finally found him, and he's reluctant at first, and then he agrees to the interview. And he's the poor white, C.P. Ellis, a poor white who's had bad luck all his life. Four kids, one kid is he loves so much is retarded. He works as a milk route, goes broke. He has a 50-gallon tank, hasn't any gasoline. One little gallon of gasoline is poured in. He's going crazy. He runs a gas station, going crazy. Finally, he's invited to join the Klan. And he said, you know something? That moment, I put the hood on and the black robe, the illuminated cross ahead of me, I'm going ahead. I felt me, a poor white, I felt like I was somebody. And suddenly as he says that, I said, wow, Jesse Jackson said that. I am somebody to operate to people, only he did it for perverse reasons. And then he becomes a Klansman, and he broke up picket lines. The woman he most hates in Durham is a black woman named Ann Atwater. And she would lead the picket lines to protest the stores not hiring black clerks. It's now in the 60s. And he's breaking up those picket lines. And then something's happened to him. He's still not getting any better. And one day, well, before that, it's Jimmy Carter time. And a couple of $1 million comes to the schools of Durham. And there's a black guy there who's on a committee who's been watching C.P. Ellis all this time. He knows something is happening to this man, C.P. Ellis. And he says, I'm going to invite everybody to this meeting who has children going to school. Members of the NAACP and the White Citizens Council. Members of Martin Luther King's group, Southern Christian Leadership Movement, and the Ku Klux Klan. And so C.P. Ellis says, I'm going. And his friends say, you out of your mind? You're going to go with those niggers? You crazy? He said, I got to go because I got a son in school. She's got a daughter. You mean her daughter's going to get something and my son's not going to get it? I got to fight for him. That's the Saul Alinsky idea, you know, self-interest, you see. And so he goes to the meeting, and it's a shambles, and they're shouting at each other, and he's being called a racist, and he's telling of his life, and he calls her one. And then the black guy says, I like C.P. Ellis. That's what guy's watching him. I think he's an honest man. And C.P. tells me the story's starting to get funny. He says, I don't know what this guy's trying to do to me, this guy. He's putting me on my head or something. What's he saying? I'm an honest man, this guy. And meantime, C.P. is starting to think, oh, they say we've got to have a committee. We can't go on this way. So I nominate Ann Atwater. Someone says, chairman of the committee. And this guy says, I nominate C.P. Ellis as co-chair to work with her. Well, think of that. Am I out of my mind? Am I going crazy? Now he starts, we agree. We don't like each other, but we got a boy in school and a girl in school. Okay. From that moment on, as he's talking, something is happening to him. He says, in the meantime, studs, I'm walking down the street. I'd get calls every night from big shots. And they say, you did right when he broke up picket line. You did great, CP. You did great. And then one day I see a guy coming toward me, one of these guys. He's going to say, he crosses the other side of the street. Not to be seen with me. Am I being used by somebody? And I see a black guy going by. He's as raggedy as I am. Is he the one who's doing me? This is bit by bit, C.P. telling me this. And now he's talking about Ann Atwater. And one day, now he's calling her Ann. And one day Ann comes in crying. Why are you coming and crying, Ann? Well, of course, the school's segregated. The black school, her daughter's going there, was humiliated by the black kids and the teacher because her mother's going around with a Klansman. He said, that's happened to my son in the white school. He said, the kids that threw sticks and stuff because going around with a black woman adjutant. And they start clinging to each other. They're in the same boat. From then on, he says, she's great. And now he becomes a janitor at Duke University, which is in Durham. And he suddenly becomes, he likes the idea of being a union organizer. And he starts organizing. It's 80% black women, this union. He's a white guy, former ex-Klansman. And he's organizing the union. He says, I'm going to run for office. And he gets up to talk to these women. And they say, you know who I am. You know my record. I'm C.P. Ellis. The company sent you out, stuff of me in a hood and all that. We know who you are. Sit down. We don't want to hear anymore. Sit down. I expect to lose. And that's when he starts sobbing about it. They elected me 4-1. They knew me. They knew my heart, he says now. And these women and me, you know what happened, Studs? He says, when the company sent the lawyers down to break the union, oh, by the way, we're the ones who made Martin Luther King's holiday a holiday here, women and me. We made the legal holiday in Durham. And when these companies send these lawyers down, college educated, me and these women, we hold our own against them. He says, you know something? Now I feel like I'm somebody. So that's C.P. Ellis. So you see, it's a story that's so powerful, I think it's biblical. It's about sin, revelation, redemption, transcendence. So that, I would say, is a pretty hot interview.
You know, I'd forgotten that I'd interviewed Muhammad Ali. It was the very first biography called The Greatest, written by my old friend Richard Durham. And Muhammad Ali was a guest on the program. This is young, vigorous Muhammad Ali.
Well, so we come to the big one, the Vietnam War, and you said, I wonder if you have nothing against the Viet Cong, and that, and then the fur began to fly.
Yeah, I made a statement that was true, but it was just, it wasn't timely, and it was bold. I said, I have no quarrel with the Viet Cong. Now before it was all over, they all started saying and got out.
But I think the pressure's on you, because, see, heavyweight champions, American athletes, are not supposed to do this. Supposed to be good boys.
Did you say joy? Oh, you said boy. Yeah, you know, well, black or white, I think if I was a white man, I can't put on my color or race. If I was a white man, I'd call more hell. Because the whites have really privileges to go places, you know. And they're really the Americans, and they're first-class citizens, you might say. We all are, but, you know, they're treated like it. And they would, the white, I think, would catch more hell than me. I had a little fight. Well, I'm not free. Well, I'm still catching hell. Like I say, we fought in the Japanese, we fought in the German war, Korea, we fought in all the wars, and still we don't have no land we can call ours. I could do all that. But a white man would really catch hell if he did what I did. I had some sympathy, because, you know, I'm black or slave. But a white man, he had no excuse. He'd really been in trouble. So I don't think this happened because I was just black. It happened worse because I was white.
Well, it happened because you were resisting the war. That's why it happened.
We just had an unpopular war that was debatable anyway, so it wasn't too hard for me. And I just got by easy. So many people went to jail. I had the public and threat of trouble in other countries help me. But what about the little man, black or white, who's in jail for not liking it? Don't nobody know he's in jail. He's not been praised for being having taken a stand. I didn't really suffer. Everybody was watching me. I was rich. The world saw me. I had lawyers to fight it. I was getting credit for being a strong man. So that didn't really mean nothing. What about, I remember the man that had to go to jail named Joe Brown or Sam Jones, who don't nobody know, who's in the cell, you understand, doing his time. Ain't got no lawyer's fees to pay. And when he get out, he won't be praised for taking a stand. So he's really stronger than me. I had the world watching me. I ain't so great. I didn't do nothing that's so great. What about the little man don't nobody know? He's really the one.
Yeah, I see. You spent some time in Dade County Jail in Miami because of this. And you saw some of the guys you're talking about there.
Yeah, I spent 7 days just for traffic violation. And man, it's a funny feeling being in a cell all day. You been in jail for anything? You been in jail?
Yeah.
I was in jail.
And every day you wake up and look at the bars and little sad hallways, couldn't see outside, and wait for the man to bring your food. Have to go to sleep, no TV or nothing. And then you wake up the next morning, same thing all day. Got to waste out the time. Then you lay down and go to sleep, wake up next morning, same thing, can't go nowhere. Then you go to sleep and wake up next morning, same thing. Then nighttime come, you're not tired, you got tired all and over, and finally you go to sleep. Next thing you know, you're waking up, it's 4 in the morning, you're not sleeping. You got to wait till 8 in the morning, then when 8 in the morning come, you can wait till 12 noon. When 12 noon come, you wait till 5 o'clock. When 5 o'clock come, you wait till 10. And then you don't want to go to bed, and then you roll over. Then you got to fight and go to sleep. The next morning, you start, just a break. Let me out of here.
This is the best description of a jail routine I've heard. You know,
and then you start thinking, how can I get out of it? They can't be that damn smart. Let me look at these bars. I know I did it. If I can make a run for it, let me look over that wall. I can't. God, somebody must have thought about this before me. He said, God, how did they can't get out of it no God way. Then you happen to get a job in the kitchen. That's like going downtown New York just to go to the kitchen and ride the elevator, see a new scene. I worked in the kitchen. They said, you can work in the kitchen or the laundry or the janitor quarters. Which one you want? I said, give me the kitchen. Because that way I can get some food. See, I steal chicken legs and put them in my pocket and wrap it up. And the fellows would help me. And I go back to my room and I eat that chicken. And then next day I had to hide the bones. So I know there were the bones. So I carried the bones back down until the next day and throw them away.
With
then you're so happy. And then when you go to the waiting room to visit the people in the waiting room, that's like being downtown Las Vegas, just looking at new faces and looking at men and women and other people, you know. Man, then when you get out of that jail, you run. You're so happy to be out. You just run down the street, just happy to run.
Why didn't you take the safe way out, Muhammad Ali? You were the champion. You were known.
I took the safe way out.
No, I meant when someone said
safe
to you,
way out. Not going.
Someone said to you, why didn't you, you could have faked it. You could have gone to training camps and just given exhibitions and that's all.
And somebody,
why didn't you do that?
Well, because still I had to sign the papers and they could use my name on stamps or something. So Muhammad Ali helped serve the country, which would be aiding in some kind of way. Even to go over there and not to fight, but just to be behind the line serving the food to the soldiers to go fight. Mentally, I'm still helping fight them. See, so I couldn't do nothing.
One of the most moving moments in this book is the induction center. Yeah, the induction center. And they wanted you to take that step. A young lieutenant says, he called your name. He may have called you Clay, or he may have called you Ali.
Clay.
But in any event, he wanted to take that step. And the kids are watching you. These are all kinds of kids, black kids and white kids, and they're watching you.
Know what's going through my mind? Clean out my cell and take my black tail on the trail to your white jail without bail. Because it's better they're eating, watching television fed, than in Vietnam with you fools dead.
This is a different thing entirely. They're two different languages being spoken.
Shall get them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own.
You say big, little, what's the difference? Man is not measured by a yardstick. The main thing is the head, not the feet. Still, if a person gets hold of some foolish notion, you never know where it may lead. Let me tell you a story. And thus begins a rather light and yet sardonic tale called Big and Little by Isaac Bashevis Singer, who is certainly one of the profound writers of our generation. Mr. Singer, you're concern with dreams and fantasy and demons, the line between reality and fantasy, a narrow one.
Well, the truth is that even in life itself, it's a short way between fantasy and reality. I would say that there's almost no difference between them in many cases. So the same thing certainly should be in literature, because literature is not only the story of what a man does, but also of how a man feels, what he thinks. And in the mind, certainly fantasy is almost everything. Many of my stories are written so that they are ambiguous. In other words, if you are a rationalist, you can also find an explanation. And if you are a believer, you find your own explanation.
So it's open, even though you write definitely. But the man who is the man can reason man, out
yes,
explanation.
Yes, he can have his choice, so to say.
At the same time, the mystic, he can have his way too.
Exactly.
I'm not going to ask which you are, am I?
I am. I will. You may ask me. I consider myself a kind of a mystic.
Would you mind perhaps expanding on this just a bit?
What I mean by this is that I feel that what we know about life and about ourselves is not everything. There are hidden powers which we don't know and which we may never know. And I always feel these powers. For example, telepathy is such a power. We all have it, although we don't know why and how it works, and we can never foresee when it will work, but it's still there. The same thing is true about dreams which come true, and so on and so on. I would say that there is some mystic in every human being, even in those who deny it.
I really
believe that we have lived many times already on this earth. I really have this feeling. Naturally, there is no evidence for it, and there will never be. But this is my personal feeling that there is a continuation. We have been here, and we are here, and we may be here again and again. In this way, I have the same belief as the Indians have. And by the way, this is a Jewish belief. Now, you don't find it in the Bible, but you find it already in the Talmud and in the Zohar and in the other Kabbalistic.
What, transfiguration?
Yes, that transmigration, that we come here again and again and again to correct certain mistakes which we did in our former lives.
So you think we've been here before?
I think so. I'm not so sure if we had an interview on the radio before.
You think you were here as somebody
might
else?
Have been naturally. I don't think that there is what Nietzsche called the eternal repetition, that we, or the ewige Wiederholung, that we come again and again in the same image. I would say that the image changes, but there is the soul is the same.
Well, obviously, Mr. Singer, you have a point of view.
Yes, I certainly have a point of view, and I don't deny it. I never do.
Yes. But do you feel this, in talking about contemporary literature today, sometimes you find this lacking?
The only thing is that the writer of today is not as sure of himself and as sure of his mission as were the writers in the 19th century.
You say they were sure of their mission.
Because writers like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Gogol still believe that literature may do a lot for human beings. It will help, while the modern writer has almost resigned of helping humanity by his writing. He has made up his mind that whatever he writes, everything will remain the same.
Well, let's quit while we're ahead. A friend of mine would say, quit when the wind is with you.
Uh-huh.
Well, for me it is. You just said this. I'm delighted that this particular phrase came out. Thus it is clear that the writings of Isaac Bashevis Singer are passionate and thus compassionate.
It's wonderful that you say these things.
Thank you very much.
The Atlanta airport, and many airports like that now. Atlanta airport is very modern. You leave the gate, right? And then you go to take trains to the concourse of ultimate choice. You go on this, you know this, the trains, and they're silent. And there's a voice up above. It once was a human voice. You know, it was once a human voice, because it's a male voice. But it sounds like a robot. They become robotic. You get this on the telephone when you call once in a while, and you have an adventure. And so, in this case, the voice is saying, Concourse 1 imitates the machine. Concourse 1, Fort Worth, Dallas, Lubbock. Concourse 2, Kansas City, St. Louis. Well, just then, about to take off, pneumatic doors about to close, young couple rush in, park the pneumatic doors, the way you do when you get into an elevator about to close. You park. And without missing a beat, the voice said, because of late entry, we delayed 30 seconds. And people look at people, you're laughing, you see. But they weren't. People look at this couple. And it's a honeymoon couple, maybe. And that couple, they're at the foot of Calvary on Good Friday. You know? Now, I happen to have a couple of drinks, a couple of martinis, to steal myself for occasions of this sort. And so I call out in the old train caller fashion, George Orwell, your timer's come and gone. You're laughing. But they didn't laugh. And suddenly look at me. So I joined the couple at the foot of Calvary. And just then I see a little baby. And there's a couple of seats, and there's a woman, and Mexican or Puerto Rican speaking Spanish. A little baby, about 6, 7, 8 months old. So I say to the baby, I hold my hand like this because my breath is 100 proof, you know. So I say to the baby, sir or madam, I says, what is your opinion of the human species, you know? And what does a baby do? Baby starts giggling. I say, thank God, a human voice. So there's hope.
Studs Terkel, The Spoken Century, is a production of the Pacifica Radio Archives. It was conceived and written by Haunani Singer. Executive producer, Brian DeShazer. Production coordinator and engineer, Mark Torres. Technical assistants, Sylvia Lubo and Curtis Metcalf. Produced and directed by Haunani Singer.